Deutsche Welle, Africa Link.
Great to have you on Africa Link this Thursday, May the 17th. Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Crispin Wakideu.
And I'm Jane Ayeko-Kumet. We are live on our studios in Bonn, Germany. Coming up, Burundians have been voting in a controversial referendum that could extend presidential term limits.
What I do today is just to agree with the content of the new constitution.
The matter is not to change the constitution because we have been ruled by the president since 2005.
And fears in the Democratic Republic of Congo after the Ebola virus reaches a city of 1 million people.
We may have already some 40 patients, which would mean that the outbreak has already been ongoing for quite some time.
Those stories, plus the UN says Nigeria's urban population could grow from 50 to 70% by 2050. We will hear what this means for Africa's most populous nation. But first, let's hear other stories making headlines around the world.
My name is Jane Nyingi with DW News. Burundians have been voting in a referendum that could allow President Pierre Nkurunziza to stay in power until 2034. Nkurunziza is already serving a controversial third term, which his opponents say is unconstitutional. Rights groups had denounced an atmosphere of intimidation in the lead-up to the vote, and the country's divided opposition had called for people to boycott the exercise. Professor Gilbert Kadiagala, an analyst on Burundi, fears the situation could escalate after the referendum.
Already there are 500,000 refugees across the region after the 2015 elections. Potentially we are going to see more refugees streaming out of the country because the government and its militias are not going to entertain the opposition forces contesting the outcome of the referendum.
The UN mission in South Sudan has announced it's sending 150 peacekeepers to Unity State to protect civilians who are being targeted in clashes between rebels and government troops. Nearly 1.7 million people have been displaced internally since fighting broke out in 2013 between troops loyal to President Salva Kiir and former Vice President Riek Machar. A series of peace deals signed by both sides have been violated, with the latest violence taking place in Unity State. Moving on, the European Union has sent a strong signal that it will keep the Iran nuclear deal alive despite the decision by US President Trump to abandon it. Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker said the EU would reactivate the blocking statute it used more than 20 years ago to counter U.S. sanctions against Cuba, Libya, and Iran. This could make it illegal for EU companies to comply with U.S. sanctions.
We are ready to discuss how to best improve reciprocal market access, notably for industrial products, including cars, as well as the liberalization of government procurement. But let me repeat, we will not negotiate with the sword of Damocles hanging over our heads. It's a matter of dignity and it's a matter of efficiency.
This news comes to you from DW in Bonn, Germany. The World Health Organization has called an emergency meeting to be held on Friday to discuss the risk of Ebola spreading internationally from the Democratic Republic of Congo. This follows confirmation of a new case in Bandaka, a city of more than 1 million people in the northwest of the country, which has sparked fears that the disease will be increasingly hard to control. The latest outbreak has already claimed 23 lives. North Korea says it will not resume talks with the South until issues between the two countries are resolved. Pyongyang is angry at continuing U.S.-South Korea joint military exercises. Planned talks between President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un have also been thrown into jeopardy. For more news and information, visit our website dw.com or our Facebook page DW Africa. My name is Jane Nyingi.
You're listening to DW's Africa Link program with me, Crispin Mwakideo.
And me, Jane Ayeko Kumet. A special welcome to you listening on our DW Facebook page. Do let us know your thoughts on the stories we are covering. But first, we begin in Burundi, where polls should be closing by now after voters cast their ballots in a controversial referendum on extending presidential term limits. If the yes vote wins, President Pierre Nkurunziza could extend his rule until 2034.
The opposition has been urging supporters to vote no or to boycott the exercise altogether. Ahead of the referendum, there were reports of heavy military presence in the capital, Bujumbura. DW correspondent Apollinaire Niyirora has been describing to me the mood in the capital.
The mood in the capital is fine. As you say, there have been presence of so many security agents in order to ensure the security or at polling stations. And the polling operation started at 6 in the morning and it ended at 4 p.m. local time here.
And what can you tell us about the turnout? Were there many people who came out to vote?
Yes, contrary to the previous elections in 2010 and 2015, the turnout is high, as I have witnessed at many polling stations here in Bujumbura, as well as reports from correspondents of local media here.
Okay, and I know it's probably too early now to tell, but from where you are and what you've been hearing, what have the voters been telling you?
I discussed with some that I met at polling stations. Some of them are saying that they voted no because they are against the amended constitution. Meanwhile, others are saying, yes, I supported the constitution because I wanted changes, as you can hear them here.
What I do today is just to agree with the content of the new constitution, that it will allow us to be in freedom, but also to be more independent, you know, economically, but also politically.
The matter is not to change the constitution. The matter is to have a constitution which has good laws, which has benefit for the population. So this constitution will allow President Nkurunziza to stay until 2034. It is not good to see the same person still being a president.
Those are the voices of some of the voters in the capital, Bujumbura. Apollinaire, what does a no vote, if in case the vote goes against the president, what would that mean for President Pierre Nkurunziza?
In case the no vote wins over the yes vote, this means that so many Burundians are supportive of the opposition coalition called Amizero y'Abarundi. It means that they are against the president, who plans to be in power for another 14 years, because the amended constitution allows for 7 years for a term, and which is renewable once, which means that the current president may run again the two terms if his party presents him as a candidate in 2020.
DW correspondent Apollinaire Niyirora in Bujumbura. And on our DW Africa Facebook page, on that story, Columbus Sebastian Chikudi Mavunga says, these presidents, one wonders if Africa is cursed. Here in Zimbabwe, we had Africa's uncle who wanted to rule forever and then leave the mantle with his wife, and now it's Nkurunziza.
And Henry Karikurubu says, it's not true that Burundians have no choice. Frankly speaking, the majority of Burundians love Nkurunziza.
And to that, Sam Oloya says, love for Nkurunziza? He's a dictator, just like President Kagame of Rwanda and Museveni of Uganda and Congo's Kabila.
Interesting comments.
And talking of Kabila, the Ebola outbreak in the Democratic Republic of Congo has entered a new phase. That's what the country's health ministry said today after a case was confirmed in the city of Mbandaka, the capital of Equateur province. Previous cases had been recorded in the remote village of Bikoro.
So far, the highly contagious virus is believed to have killed 23 people. The World Health Organization has dispatched an experimental vaccine in a bid to help stop the spread and contain the virus. Max Gertler is an epidemiologist with the Institute of Tropical Medicine at Charité Hospital in Berlin. That he told me what he makes of the first Ebola case.
The appearance of the outbreak in the big city of Mbandaka is, of course, a risk. Another aspect is that we may have already some 40 patients, which would mean that the outbreak has already been ongoing for quite some time, which leaves us with the information that it must have been ongoing for quite several weeks. So there may be other clusters of which we do not know yet.
Now, the World Health Organization had already warned about the risk of the virus spreading to Mbandaka. That's the city of about 1 million people. What do you think went wrong in terms of containing it within Ground Zero?
People are mobile, maybe more mobile. And this person, which we found positive yesterday, may have traveled to Mbandaka before the outbreak was detected in the epicenter.
Now, World Health Organization is in the process of distributing an experimental vaccine to counter the spread of the virus in DRC. How hopeful should we be about the vaccine's effect to reduce or to stop the outbreak?
This, what we call an investigational vaccine, is not yet a licensed vaccine, but will be implemented within a study protocol, which has been accepted by the national authorities and the ethical review board in Kinshasa, DRC. And from the results in Guinea, we have a lot of hope that this may help to counter and to contain the outbreak soon. But we know that Ebola can be very quick, and therefore it appears to us essential that although we have the vaccine now, we need to implement rapidly and strongly with the approved tools that we have against Ebola.
Now that you talk about containing it, what chances are there that this outbreak could reach the scale of what we witnessed in West Africa, Liberia, Guinea and Sierra Leone back in 2014?
We see now that not only MSF, but the Ministry of Health in DRC and WHO are on the ground. But there's a strong international response starting right now. In West Africa, we had several months during which nobody except the national health systems and MSF and some other partners was responding, which was the main reason for the important spread and the extent of the outbreak in 2014.
Max Gettler, an epidemiologist with the Institute of Tropical Medicine at Charité Hospital in Berlin.
And we hope, Ayeko, that they are able to contain the Ebola outbreak in Congo very, very fast.
That's our wish.
Right. Now, get this. Around 2.5 billion more people will be living in cities by 2050. That's according to a new report released by the UN's Department of Economic and Social Affairs.
India, China and Nigeria will account for this additional number of people. Rapid urban population growth poses challenges for sustainable development. Consequently, the body calls for more sustainable urban planning. Benita van Eisen with the details.
Owing to demographic shifts and overall population growth, more and more people are moving to urban areas. Most of the increase is expected to be highly concentrated in India, whose urban population will increase by 416 million people. China will see an additional 255 million and Nigeria 189 million. The three countries alone will account for 35% of the projected growth of the world's urban population between 2018 and 2050. Currently, 55% of the world's population is urban-based, but come 2050, it will be 68%, with India's capital New Delhi being the most populous city on the planet. Tokyo is the world's largest, with an agglomeration of 37 million inhabitants, followed by New Delhi with 29 million urban dwellers. The body warns that the world's growing urban population poses challenges to sustainable development as it puts extra demands on both resources and services in urban areas. It, however, notes that well-managed urbanization, informed by an understanding of population trends over the long run, can help to maximize the benefits of agglomeration while minimizing environmental degradation and other potential adverse impacts of a growing number of city dwellers.
Benita van Eisen with that story on the growing number of urban dwellers around the world.
Right, and Alams Dante says the bomb will explode in 2019, not 2050. You will see it happen.
That's an interesting one. It's also not a bad idea. Like, the report actually does indicate it's all about proper planning. And if that is done, all will be fine. This is Africa Link, DW's program that brings you closer to Africa, African stories, by giving you a chance to comment directly on our Facebook page. I am Jane Ayeko Kumet.
And I'm Crispin Mwakideo. Still to come, the trials and persecution of being a teenage father in Uganda.
I was feeling so embarrassed. No one thought I was capable of doing such a thing. So I felt like I'd lost all the trust in everyone.
Well, want to find out more about the challenges of being a dad at the age of 19? Then stay with Africa Link. But first, let's head to South Sudan, where the UN peacekeeping mission said it is sending 150 troops to Unity State. The peacekeepers are meant to protect civilians from fighting between government forces and the rebels.
And this comes as peace talks to end South Sudan's civil war resumed today in Ethiopia's capital, Addis Ababa. DW correspondent Wake Simon Wudu mingled with the delegates from the warring sides and sent us this report.
As the peace talks resumed today, regional and international leaders did not mince their words to South Sudanese leaders over their failure to end the conflict. Kwai Kwati, African Union deputy chairperson, says the African Union is disappointed by the little efforts the South Sudanese leaders are making to end the conflict.
It will not be fair for anyone to argue that the African Union decision to take punitive measures against those that kill or contribute to the killing of the citizens every day is unjustifiable. The African Union is going to work tirelessly with IGAD and other partners to punish those who obstruct efforts towards peace, and will do that without fail.
The regional body, Intergovernmental Authority on Development, which is mediating the talks, has on several occasions attempted to have the two sides respect a peace agreement, but have so far failed. Key areas of contention the parties are expected to compromise on in the 5 days negotiations are power sharing and security arrangements, as explained by Simon Akwe Deng, one of the delegates representing the civil society at the talks.
The structure of the executives. How do the executive look like? The presidency, the vice presidencies, vice presidents, and the rest of the positions that are required to be filled. Then the second one is the power sharing ratios, the cabinet, and at what level. The third one is the number of states. How many states should we, vis-a-vis the axis that talk about 10, the government has 32. So that is the point that need to be resolved. And then the fourth one is the legislature.
Another issue is security. While the government insists on rebel forces to be integrated into the national army, the opposition is demanding unification of the army, which should include the dissolution of the government SPLA army. Sponsored by the Troika, a group comprising the US, UK, and Norway, the peace talks have also drawn pressure groups such as religious leaders and activists. Archbishop Justin Badi Arama, the head of the Anglican Church in South Sudan, says it's time the parties put aside their political differences and end the conflict.
In history of the world, all wars end in dialogue. It is not a military success that ends wars. So if they love their people, before the people finish, they should listen and then come up and then embrace peace.
There has been a growing international pressure on South Sudan's government to ink a peace deal as the mandate of the transitional government of national unity comes to an end this month.
Wake Simon Wudu in Addis Ababa. And one can imagine the frustration that the South Sudanese must be feeling, you know, with these peace talks failing and then resuming and failing and resuming. I don't know how long this can go on.
Yes, the ordinary people are the ones that feel the pinch. But even us within the region, I think as people from the region, all we want is peace.
That's
in
very
the country.
True. That's very true.
Speaking out.
And peace and reconciliation can be a struggle for many nations that have gone through radical political differences. Most African countries have dark history of colonialism that subjected indigenous people to anguish, agony, and living under inhuman conditions.
Now, after such experiences, reconciliation could be the foundation for peaceful coexistence. But this does not often come easily. In Zimbabwe, one peace campaigner, Bob Scott, has authored a book known as Saving Zimbabwe. It features the killing of 16 people in the southern part of the country in November 1987. He is now in the country to promote reconciliation. Privilege Mushanri caught up with him and filed this report.
We were seated one evening and people just emerged saying they were here to kill the white people. I was one of the people who were meant to be killed. What happened was at a stage when we thought we were now independent, but evil descended upon us and 16 white people were killed. We were saddened and dumbfounded. This is what hurt us the most.
That is 90-year-old Stephen Ngwe. He was part of the Community of Reconciliation in southern Zimbabwe, a community established to promote coexistence after the country gained independence in 1980. In his book, Saving Zimbabwe, 61-year-old Bob Scott highlights the tragedy that confronted the country at the time. The American peace campaigner who left the country many years ago is back to promote his book, which talks about a possibility to live in a racially integrated Zimbabwean society.
This was a tragedy that crossed cultures. It's one that many, many people in this country can identify with because almost everyone here has suffered loss in some capacity. Zimbabwe, once again, can be a racially integrated, tribally integrated country where we respect one another and honor each other's diversity instead of seeing it as a threat.
Zimbabwe has a dark past. Both the white men regimes and the leadership of ZANU-PF committed atrocities, but none has ever apologized to the victims. Unlike its neighbor, South Africa, which established truth and reconciliation processes to deal with apartheid issues, it has taken long for Zimbabwe to establish such a platform. Religious leaders such as Hussein Sibanda of the Zimbabwe Christian Alliance, a peace think tank, says the country has a chance to make amends.
There is a window of opportunity because first, this current administration think they need to think about their own legacy. How do they salvage their legacy from Mugabe regime days, which tarnished their image.
However, Scott says the process cannot be driven by government, but through personal interactions where individuals realize their humanity.
The people of Zimbabwe want peace and reconciliation. It's now it's up to the government to deliver their dreams. Peace and reconciliation is the fundamental foundation on which everything else is dependent.
Given the need to deal with atrocities from the past, the Zimbabwe government has established the National Peace and Reconciliation Commission. Citizens are slowly beginning to openly discuss about the unresolved massacres. Hopefully, the reconciliation efforts will put a closure to the issues that has often dragged the country to the past.
Privilege Mushanri sent us that report from Zimbabwe.
Uzon.
And now we bring you that story of teenage fathers. Usually, most teenage pregnancies, much attention is, or should I say, condemnation goes to the pregnant girl.
But what is the experience like for boys who become parents at an early age? Frank Kiga in Kampala went to find out. And as he reports, in Uganda, a quarter of adolescents between the ages of 15 to 19 have become parents.
...18-year-old Brian Tumwebazi has just completed his secondary education at St. Mary's School in Mbarara district of Uganda. He was used to being treasured by his family, being the last born. But his special status crumbled when his family found out he had got a girl pregnant. He remembers how bad he felt when he was told the consequences of his actions.
It was so stressing. So the news reached my mother and I was feeling so embarrassed. No one thought I was capable of doing such a thing. So I felt like I'd lost all the trust in everyone.
Despite the embarrassment he faced, Brian was determined to become a responsible father.
I want to work so hard so I fulfill my mission of being a very successful young man so that I can be able to take care of the kid.
But finding work can be difficult, as Pius Katongole found out. His world fell apart the day he lost his job in Bunga, a suburb of the capital Kampala. Then things got worse when he discovered he was about to become a father at the age of 19. Unable to find new work, he was forced to return to his village to try and get his life back on track.
Melo. Honey, baby.
Pius and Brian's efforts to support their partners and children are the exception, not the rule in Uganda. For the teenage mothers, the situation is usually much more difficult. 17-year-old Media Staban dropped out of school when she realized she was pregnant. After giving birth, she ended up back home with her mother in Chengeta town. She split with the father after constant arguing, and he is no longer present in their lives.
I went and pleaded with my mom, and they forgave me and took me back home with my son. Everything is being done by my parents. My mom has encouraged me to go back to school so I can finish my O-level certificate. And then I see what the future has to offer for me, but I've learned a very big lesson from this experience.
Susan Ajok at the Straight Talk Foundation thinks it is important to equip both boys and girls with access to sexual and reproductive health services and rights. Even though it may be easier for boys to walk away from the problem, she thinks they also often face stigma from their families and can cut short their education because of an unplanned pregnancy.
Becoming a parent, especially if you haven't planned for it, is a challenge. Realize that you become a father, you've made someone's daughter pregnant. You are not viewed differently. You might be rejected by your own family, you might be forced to marry this girl.
The Ugandan government recognizes that teenage pregnancy is blighting the lives of many young people. The hope is that by removing some of the stigma surrounding teenage pregnancy, young people are able to continue with their lives with as little disruption as possible and work hard to improve their own futures and that of the whole country.
Frank Yiga reporting in Kampala. And that post obviously did get a lot of comments on our Facebook page.
Crispin, I got to tell you this one. The story was about condemnation or responsibility, but there is one person here, Atiene Awa, says, boy, you be very blessed beyond expectations. You just need to thank God and pray he turns your mistakes into blessings because many have no children.
And there's some truth in that as well.
He looks at the positive side of the coin.
Right. And Okonkwo Chukwukadibia says, I like his courage. A lot have done abortion instead of raising their kids.
Well, Terry Harris says, how many of us were planned for anyway? Crispin, I don't want to ask you this question, but it's an interesting one. Obviously, your parents didn't have protected sex. Why should we shun others doing that? No parent wants this for their children, but if it happens, they should be supported.
And Sunday Chuku wraps it up and says, I wish I had made such a mistake when I was young. I think it would have been better story. It would have been a better story for me by now. I don't know whether Sunday really means that.
Possibly it's a joke, a sarcastic statement that he makes in there. Anyhow, Crispin, one other story that we've been covering on our social media page is that Zambian President Edgar Lungu is reportedly building a $4 million mansion in Swaziland. Should sitting African leaders invest in foreign countries? That's the question we asked you, and certainly you've been sharing your comments.
Right, and Sandio Lubisi says there is no foreign country in Africa. He's free to build a mansion in Swaziland. Well, actually, it's not Swaziland. He changed the name of the country.
Yes,
The Kingdom of Eswati or something
like that. Yes, I think that's something that we should encourage our listeners to go find out. Yes, and Vincent Wamazembe says, African leaders are all robbers. Very good question, but there is no law which stops them from investing in foreign countries. And in fact, European countries benefit from African leaders who are keeping huge chunks of money in their banks.
Alitu Danladi Edmundo Nasigri. Well, that's a very long name there. Mm-hmm. He says this is nothing but pure robbery. When citizens of Zambia need better roads, hospitals, schools, and many more, he is stupidly investing the stolen money in different country. When are African leaders going to stop this naked thievery and economic iniquities? I only blame the Zambian electorates.
Very, very interesting comments there. So much of that, but you can still join the debate by going to our Facebook page, that is DW Africa.
Thank you very much for your contributions. From me, Crispin Mwakideo.
And me, Jane Ayeko Kumet.
Thank you and good day.
Bye-bye.